Would they stand, please? Good afternoon. Thank you for coming. Please be seated. Have you had materials about this case? So you're aware of it? Good. We generally have groups from various schools and colleges, and want to thank you for coming today. We've met you, so now you should meet us. Starting on my far right is Justice David Prosser. Seated next to him is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate right is Justice William Babbage. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. My left is an empty chair, and the late John Wilcox resides there. The left of the empty chair is Justice Patrick Crooks, and on the far left is Justice Diane Sykes. I'll call our third case for today, which is 01-0231, Renee Van Cleve et al. Versus the City of Marinette. Our first counsel representing Renee and Thomas Van Cleve is Johnny L. Wara. Pardon me? Counsel, you're from Michigan. Have you been admitted?
Yes, Your Honor.
Are you a counsel, are you a Wisconsin lawyer, or are you admitted pro hoc vici?
No, I'm a Wisconsin lawyer also, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, Chief Justice Abrahamson, counsel, Johnny War of the law firm of Petruccelli & Petruccelli, appearing on behalf of the petitioners Renee Van Cleve and Thomas Van Cleve. Very briefly, it's a privilege and an honor to be appearing before you today. This case, as I'm sure you're well aware from having read the briefs, surrounds the application of a parenter agreement with the statute set forth in 81.17 of the Wisconsin statutes. As a brief factual background, there was a lawsuit filed by the petitioners against the City of Marinette, as well as Ken Keller doing business as Keller Cement Contractors. In that, prior to trial, a settlement was reached with Ken Keller for $7,500. A parenter agreement was entered into, which has been attached and which I believe is part of the record. A jury trial then commenced against the City of Marinette, whereby a jury allocated causal negligence, 90% against the City of Marinette, 9% against Ken Keller, and 1% against the petitioners, Renee Van Cleve and Thomas Van Cleve. Damages were awarded in an amount of $15,000 for past non-economic loss damages and $60,000 for future non-economic loss damages. Following trial, the defendant city filed a motion for a directed verdict claiming that 81.17 precluded enforcement of any type of judgment and the city was entitled to dismissal. The circuit court denied the motion. It was appealed to the Court of Appeals and there was a published decision. In this situation, I'd first like to address, I believe there's two different types of it. There's two issues. Number one, whether 81.17 even applies to this type of situation and whether the City of Marinette waived its right to rely on the statute. But I think more importantly, this is an even if argument. Even if we assume that 81.17 applies, if that's not even a contended issue, when you look at the clear language of 81.17, it's clear that the plaintiffs, petitioners, can satisfy the requirements. And I believe where the Court of Appeals erred is they considered 81.17 as an absolute immunity type of statute, as opposed to what the statute itself says, which is basically a priority collection statute. The clear language of the statute shows that if the town, city, village, or county denies its primary liability and proves upon whom such liability rests, the judgment shall be against all the defendants. It doesn't say just against the primary party. It says all the defendants. And then the statute goes on to say that if the judgment can't be satisfied against the primary liability, then judgment can be entered, as in any other type of case, against the secondarily liable party.
Counsel, that bothered me also, or at least caused me to pause. The characterization of 8117 as a immunity statute, or perhaps they said quasi-immunity. I think, did they say quasi-immunity?
I believe they said something to that nature, Your Honor.
And reading that, I just wasn't sure that it comported with what my idea of an immunity, at first blush, what my idea of an immunity statute would be. And then I thought, well, it seems like maybe it's more of a indemnification or quasi-indemnification statute or limited contribution statute. Does that, I don't know how to say, is there any validity in that? I guess that's what I'm saying. Is there any validity in the approach of this is indemnification or a quasi-indemnification or contribution statute?
Well, Justice Bradley, I read the literal language of it as not being an immunity statute.
Yeah.
We have governmental immunity of 893.80 parent 3, which limits liability to $50,000 for municipalities. That's the governmental liability statute in this case, which the legislature has enacted. This very precise and limited statute, by its own language, I would agree, is a collection type. I characterize it as a collection.
I know you do, and I thought, well, you know, this is, we're not talking about it is maybe a collection statute, but saying it's a collection statute doesn't necessarily give me a body of law for analysis. And saying it's a contribution statute or quasi-contribution or quasi-indemnification statute might, but I'm not sure I can say it is a quasi-indemnification or contribution. It smells like it a little bit.
I would agree that there are certain aspects of it that when you look at primary liability and secondary liability, that the primary liability party can look to the secondary liability if it's established. But I don't think from the clear language that there's anything in here about contribution, indemnification, uh-huh, or immunity. And so therefore I think that from our perspective, you have to read the literal language of the statute, and one of the difficulties with this case is there is really no case law dealing with this other than the Weiss case, which is a 1950s case, which we believe is distinguishable from the present situation because there was in this case there's a direct action, and in that case there was a cross claim, and under the facts and circumstances of Weiss you couldn't have any type of secondary or primary liability on the part of the city.
Well, let's, maybe we can get at it this way, maybe we can't. Let's forget the release for the moment. And let's say we have a jury verdict for 90% city, 9% tortfeasor, and 1% plaintiff, right? Which is what we had here.
Yes.
All right. And the 9% tortfeasor is insured. Let us assume the insurance is for $100,000, okay? Now, what can plaintiff recover from the tortfeasor, and what can the plaintiff recover from the city? And what, if any, rights does the tortfeasor have against the city?
If there was no release and they went to the
loss. Straight
Sure.
Case.
Chief Justice Abrahams, I think that there's an issue as to whether or not 8117 would apply or whether the joint and several liability statute of 895.
Okay, that's the one I was looking at. What does that say?
I believe under that circumstance that because the city was 90% causally negligent, they potentially would have to be fully. I mean, I believe there's a I think the Keller would be 9%, and then the city would be potentially jointly and severally liable under that enactment of joint and several liability because they're over 51%. And I think that when you look at that legislative act, it occurs after 8117, and there's nothing in the joint and several liability statute to say, well, this doesn't apply to cities.
Okay.
It says all parties. It doesn't say anything about we're going to make an exception for cities, and they could have done that once again in that enactment. And we can only presume that the legislature was aware of 81.17 when it enacted the new joint and several liability statute. So from our perspective, there's already a conflict, and it's our position that the joint and several liability statute would be controlling because there's no clear language to the contrary that cities are exempted, even under 81.17.
That was the point of my question. So you'd get into a situation where the tortfeasor would be only liable if 895 applied, only for 9%. Max.
Yes, that would be what they would be liable to under.
And then what? Then you can't collect theoretically from the tortfeasor any more than the 9%.
I don't believe you could, and I don't think you could get over $50,000 from the city either, because they're still subject to the governmental immunity which has been provided to them.
Okay, so it's the reason I'm asking this is because when I looked at the Court of Appeals decision, I'm not sure they stated it right. If both the municipality and the contractor are found liable, regardless of the apportionment between them, the contractor is responsible for the entire award if it can pay. You don't agree with that, do you?
No, I don't. I haven't seen anything that would stand for that proposition, especially with the statutes the way they are.
Now, was that statute, the joint and several liability statute, in effect when this accident occurred?
This accident occurred in August 24th of 1998, so I'm not sure. I'm not sure of the legislation.
Well, that may or may not be right, but if it would have to be modified anyway, not to raise that issue since that's not the one you're here on.
Yeah.
Okay. But suppose that statute was not in effect, all right?
Okay.
So we're dealing with the old law. Under the old law, anyone who had any liability, assuming it was more than the plaintiff, would be liable. So now we got the tortfeasor. The tortfeasor has $100,000 insurance. You go after the tortfeasor first. Is that what the statute says?
I believe that under 8117, if we assume that it applies, that judgment could be pursued against the primarily liable person up until their collectible status.
Okay, so if they had all the insurance, you'd collect all from them?
I think you probably could under the statute.
All right. Now, what are the... Again, we're not dealing with a Peeringer. I want to get it sort of straight without Peeringer before I go into something I don't quite understand. So now, would Keller have the right of contribution against the city?
I don't believe under the statute, 8117, there would be any contribution.
Knocks it out.
I believe the statute would knock it out.
So if Keller only had $25,000 insurance and was, in effect, judgment-proof, couldn't collect the other $25,000 from him, then the city would be liable for the $25,000.
The city would be liable for any part of the judgment that remained unsatisfied in whole or in part.
All right.
Okay, but do you think that the joint several liability statute raises a problem?
I think it raises a problem with whether 8117 is even applicable anymore to the cities, municipalities, because the legislature did not make any demarcation between a municipality and any other party. 895 is very clear that it's all parties are entitled to...
What do we do if 895 was in effect, and I didn't see it in your brief. I know that it was referenced in your opposing counsel's brief, but just referenced. What do we do if 895 was in effect, well before your accident, a couple years before your accident?
Well, I would take the position that 81.17 isn't even applicable to this as a matter of law, because 895 clearly supersedes 81.17, which...
Why does it so clearly supersede it? 8117 deals, if I recall, with want of insufficiency or want of repair of highway. Am I right, I think?
Yes.
Okay. We're dealing with a very narrow statute. I mean, arguably, everything else is 895, 045, everything else is that, and except when you deal with insufficiency or want of repair of highway, 8115 and 8117.
Well, I would say if the legislature wanted to do it that way, they would have said it, and they didn't say it. And they could only be presumed to have known about this 8117 with regard to primary and secondary liability with municipalities.
Was joint and several liability the rule at the time that 8117 was adopted?
I don't know, Justice Sykes.
Well, the statute seems to require, and the case cited there seems to be require, that you have more than one tortfeasor. This section creates a secondary liability in a municipality or county for highway defects that cause damage only when the act or default of another tortfeasor also contributes. Now, I know joint and several liability is not an easy area.
My recollection of this statute is that it goes back to 8117 goes back to 1889. Because I know I was reading an 1890 case that dealt with this, virtually the same words. So its predecessor, I think, goes back that far.
I believe that's correct, Justice Brown. And so I guess,
counsel, was any effort made to have Judge Duguid enter judgment against all of the parties that were found liable as far as the verdict was concerned? I noticed the statute talks about the fact that the judgment shall be against all the defendants shown by the verdict or found to be liable for damages. Anybody make a request like that?
No, Justice Brooks. There was a judgment entered simply against the city and Wausau, because at the trial court level, the judge ruled in our favor. There was no need to even avail ourselves of 8117 at that point. I guess one of the issues...
Keller was dismissed.
He was dismissed before.
So it would be hard to get a judgment against him.
Well, actually, I don't think... I believe that, as I've set forth in our position, that judgment can be entered against Keller. It's set forth specifically in the Perringer release that if any portion... that judgment could be entered for any portion or allocation of what he's found liable, what his corporation's found liable, and under the stipulation and order dismissing the case, it was reserved that the court would have jurisdiction to enter any types, enter any terms of the settlement.
I know, but there was an indemnification, so you're really entering a judgment against the plaintiff for in behalf of the plaintiff.
Yeah, to satisfy that portion of Keller's causal negligence.
It would not be, in effect, a judgment against Keller. It would be a judgment against Van Cleve, in favor of Van Cleve.
I guess it would be our position, Chief Justice Abrahamson, that it would be judgment entered against Keller pursuant to the terms of...
But there's an indemnification, right? Didn't Van Cleave agree to indemnify Keller against any damages he might suffer?
Yes, up to and including the per causal percentage that any jury could allocate.
All right.
I guess I would simply just say that we would, that the language of the Perringer in the second paragraph, or actually on the second page, is a further consideration of this lease. The understanding agreed to identify the release parties, and then it goes on to talk about if there's no immediate satisfaction of the judgment, the release can simply be filed, and then the judgment would be entered.
What about the statute deals not with an entered judgment, but with enforcement of a judgment? Aren't I correct?
81.17?
Yeah, I thought it was an enforcement of a judgment rather than entry of a judgment.
I think that my read of 81.17 is that if a judgment is entered against Keller, that or there's any judgment remaining from the verdict that remains unsatisfied in whole or in part, then the city would be responsible for the remainder. And I would simply like to...
Let me ask you, Colin. It says, but judgment against the town, city, village, or county shall not be enforceable until execution has been issued against the party found to be primary liable, returned unsatisfied in whole or part. And then it said that... So it's talking about judgment. And I'm talking about 8117.
Yes, and it's our position that judgment can be entered, and it'll be returned unsatisfied in whole or in part, and then the city is responsible for the rest. And I think there's somewhat of an important distinction here, is that we're not asking the city to pay anything other than what the jury allocated. The jury allocated 90% to the city. We're not asking the city to be jointly and severally liable over and above what, it's not like there's 9% and 90%. We're asking the city simply to be responsible for the 90% allocation that was rendered against them in this.
Is there a way that these two statutes can be reconciled, 8117 and 895045, as amended in 1995? Doesn't 8117 seem to presuppose a regime of joint and several liability where a plaintiff can recover against one, his whole judgment against one tortfeasor, and then the others look to the non-paying joint tortfeasor for contribution, right?
It would appear that there's a joint type of relationship in the 8117.
Right, and those common law rules were codified in 895045 and then amended in 1995 by the legislature in connection with some tort reform legislation that limited the concept of joint and several liability. In other words, if you're less than 51% liable as a joint tortfeasor defendant, you cannot be held responsible for the entire judgment, only that portion which is allocated to you in the comparative negligence equation.
Yes, I would agree.
So how do we reconcile that statute as amended with 8117?
I think that I don't know if you need to reconcile them.
I think we do.
I think that when you look at 8117 by its terms itself, they speak for themselves. But it can be reconciled because 895 was later, and the city would still enjoy its governmental immunity. That's how I think it can be reconciled. I think it applies to all parties, and the city still has its immunity. So if it's 90%, even in a joint and several liability framework, the city would be limited to $50,000 in any event.
As I see the Court of... Are you finished, Justice Sykes? Are there more questions?
For the moment. Thank you.
As I see the Court of Appeals majority, if I recall, it kind of says, look, this is an anachronism. We wish it weren't here. I think there was a case in the 60s that I looked at that said then that 8117 is an anachronism. You know, we have now the 50,000 cap on damages. This is pre-Perringer. There was a case in the 70s that said, hey, 8117 is an anachronism, but it's still there. Legislature, do something about it. And I think an argument can be made with 895045. It even gets worse. Legislature, do something about it. So that's what I understand the Court of Appeals opinion to, in part, suggest. So why aren't you stuck with it?
Well, I think we're not stuck with it because even under the terms of it itself, we can comply with the terms and we can still enter judgment against the city for the remaining judgment that remains unsatisfied in whole or in part. Number one. Number two, I think there's this whole issue about superseding with 895. And number three, as I've set forth in my brief, I think that the city waived its right to even rely on 81.17 under the facts of this situation with the Perringer, because they were in a unique position to argue against a Perringer type of situation here, strictly because of 8117, if it applies. And because they failed to do anything or take any action, they, from our perspective, acquiesced in entering judgment against Keller for the Perringer amount, and the remaining will remain unsatisfied. From our perspective, they could have said, listen, we have 81.17 here. We're not going to agree to a Perringer. We're not going to stipulate to dismiss the cross claims because we want to be able to come back later and rely on 81.17. And we're afraid that by doing it this way, we're giving up our rights under 81.17. They never did anything like that. The first time that I heard about this, of course it was in the affirmative defenses, but the first time this 8117 issue ever came about was after trial, after the jury verdict.
Just let me get this. So you think that by not objecting to the Perringer, that they acquiesced in it? What standing or what right did they have in saying, no, we don't think you should have a Perringer? That isn't a position that they could take anyway, could they?
I believe they could, because typically a joint tortfeasor can't object to a Perringer agreement. But given the statute, if it applies, it's my position, it's our position, that they had a right to object to it because it's a specific right delineated specifically to a municipality, and they could have said, we have this primary and secondary liability issue, and we don't want this to dismiss the cross-claim for potential indemnification or contribution. They are different than any other joint tortfeasor because no other joint tortfeasor has the statute to rely upon. They're the city. And that's why I think they have standing to object to the Perringer under these facts and circumstances.
Why?
Go ahead.
Why did the plaintiff want a Perringer agreement with Keller?
Well, I think it was part of the settlement, Justice Prosser. It was just the defendant wanted a Perringer because they wanted to be protected. The plaintiffs felt that with the relative strengths of the case, that $7,500 was an appropriate amount to try to settle for the Perringer. If a jury were to come back, and I see my red lights on, I don't know if I'm...
Please continue answering the question.
Okay, thank you. If the jury would have come back and said 90% negligence against Keller, 9% against the city, which could have happened, then the city would have gained the advantage of the 90%. That's not the way that it turned out, but that was the possible way. It was just a situation that we felt, given the facts and circumstances, and the clients believed that it was a reasonable amount, and we were willing to set off that portion of any settlement under an indemnification under the Perringer terms. But we certainly didn't anticipate or intend, or did the defense ever bring up that, you know, by entering into this Perringer, that you could be, you're not going to be able to obtain a judgment, and we're going to rely on 8117. There was even a pretrial conference, and I don't know if it's it was reported, but defense counsel, prior counsel, had indicated, the judge asked him, what's going to happen if we have a Perringer? Is this just standard Perringer? He said, yes. That was the only thing that was ever said prior to jury verdict, and then afterwards we get this 81.17 motion. So it's my position that the parties were all going into this knowingly. It's not like the city did not know about the Perringer. They were provided a copy of it. And under the terms, the terms of the Perringer, under the clear language of 81.17, we believe that we can comply and that the Court of Appeals clearly erred, and they looked at it as an absolute immunity statute as opposed to a priority type of collection statute, as I would characterize it. I understand it's somewhat like a quasi-indemnification statute. And the only other thing is I don't think the city has ever said that the judgment could not be entered against Keller. They say it, but they don't provide any basis for why it can't under the clear language of the Perringer release. Unless there's any other questions, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Farb, representing City of Marinette, Warsaw Insurance.
Thank you, Your Honor. Since I anticipate a lot of questions, let me try and shorten up part of it a little bit. I think the Court of Appeals decision is absolutely correct until you get to the last paragraph. And that's the paragraph where they talk about the statute being an anachronism. I believe that the reason for this statute, they go through and they examine the history, that 8115, which is the highway defect statute, was created by the legislature. In response to that, municipalities enacted their own versions of 8117, saying, if our negligence combines with someone else, that someone else is liable primarily and we're only secondary. In reaction to that, the legislature enacted 8117. And the reason why I think it's still valid today, if you think about the city of Milwaukee, for example, it's got thousands of miles of streets and sidewalks. If there's a problem that exists with one of those, say, for 6 months, then the doctrine of the idea that it's been there long enough that they should have known about it comes into play. But if that problem was caused by some contractor who was actually at that site, that contractor clearly has notice of that problem. And that's what this is here to deal with. And that's exactly what we face in this case today. A contractor who was supposed to be taking care of this problem and didn't. And he obviously was there because he put it in the curb, he put it in the gutter, and failed to backfill it. So I think that's why 8117 is not an anachronism.
I also think that the city was assigned 90% liability then.
I don't know. I was not trial counsel, sorry. But my understanding is that there was some issue about the city being alerted to the problem at some point later. I'm assuming that's what the basis was. A couple of points that the council has raised that I have to strongly disagree with. He said the judgment can still be entered against Keller. Well, it can't. If you look in the record, you will see there is a stipulation in order for judgment dismissal with prejudice. They dismissed their claims against Keller with prejudice. Now, I don't know how you reopen that other than a motion to the court or getting Keller to agree to it. I strongly suspect Keller would not agree to reopening their Perringer. In terms of the argument that we could somehow object to the Perringer, that's not true. A Perringer is what a Perringer is. It says that any cross claims for contribution that I may have are gone. The distinction here is that 8117 is not giving me a cross claim for contribution. What it's saying is the Keller people are primarily responsible. It doesn't give me any rights against Keller, it gives the plaintiffs rights against Keller. And those are the rights that they gave up when they signed the Perringer.
If the Perringer had contained a provision that says, and Keller signs it and says, and I hereby confess judgment in the amount of $7,500, then would judgment be able to be entered?
No, I don't think so, because when you look at the statute, it very clearly says there has to be an execution upon the judgment issued and returned unsatisfied.
Well, if you had, I mean, your opposing counsel's argument doesn't deal with the statement in the Perringer that would say, I confess judgment. But I'm saying, hypothetically, if you had that, that you said, I confess judgment, judgment then could be entered.
Yes.
Now the question, okay.
Yes.
I don't know if you agree with that, but it's at least an argument. Judgment could be entered if it's confessed. Then the question is, can it be enforced? And the way that I look at the statute, that's what this statute in part is about, not entry of judgment, but enforcement of judgment. And the argument could unfold that, look, you've got a judgment entered, but it can't be enforced beyond $7,500 because that's all that was confessed. And so it's only a partial enforcement, then you go against the city of Marinette. What's wrong with that?
The flaw there is that if they're confessing judgment to $7,500 and they pay it, that's it. There is no other judgment.
Judgment as to them.
Yeah, what it says is there has to be a judgment that is not satisfied. And the judgment there would be satisfied when they pay the $7,500. So that the statutory language would never be triggered.
Let me ask a question. That this 8117 goes back to the 1800s.
As a state statute, yes, it goes back further in the 1800s as a city.
If I understand this correctly, when a plaintiff is injured and the municipality is one of the defendants, but a private party is another defendant, so long as the private party is found 1% liable, the private party can responsible for the entire bill.
Exactly.
Okay. Now, this goes, if this shifting of liability goes all the way back to 1889 or whatever, it would seem to me that contractors must have had a way to deal with that. I mean, if you're dealing with a municipality that is stupid in its negligence, but you are expected to pick up the tab, you're going to respond some way to avoid that, I would think. Okay, so that these releases, I think, cannot be new, are they?
Perringer releases or releases of contractors?
I mean, Perringer, was that go back to the early 60s, something like that?
I think Perringer is 1958.
Why would a contractor ever permit itself to pick up the entire tab?
Well, see, that raises another interesting question, which I can't answer why it wasn't done in this case. But the contractor actually tells the contractor that he has to name the city of Marinette as an additional insured under this policy. Now, if for whatever reason prior counsel didn't make that an issue, but they, you know, in my mind they could have, and that would have said, look, when you're doing a contract for the city, you've got to protect the city as well through your insurance. Why that argument wasn't done before, I don't know. But you've raised an interesting question, two things there. Talking about what's the effect of 8117 and 894 and 8945, which is a comparative negligence. If you look at the Weiss case, Weiss is very clear. Now, Weiss talks about, and that's 271 Wisconsin 140, Weiss versus Gibson. If you recall, prior to the enactment of the statute on contributory negligence or comparative negligence, you folks adopted that standard or that requirement in the case of Ainsworth versus Bird. And what the Weiss case says, 271 Wisconsin 144, by statute, the liabilities of these tortfeasors from the outset are successive rather than joint, which prevents the application of the Ainsworth versus Bird doctrine. So right there in the Weiss decision, it's saying this is not joint and several. This is successive. And that's the answer to why it would still apply today. If you look at their argument, essentially, if you accept it, there is no more 8117 here.
And, you know, 8117 came into effect when there was the municipal union.
I'm sorry?
8117 came into effect when there was the municipal union.
Except on the issue of highway defense.
That's right. So it made a rule for liability of municipalities under certain conditions. And what it did, it then went on to say, okay, we're doing that. But what we're saying is first the other party, and then second liability to the city.
Yes.
Now, that's what 895.045 is also doing in a way. It is saying that primary liability goes to the one that's over 51%. And secondary liability for a limited part goes to somebody less than 51%.
That's a difference.
Right?
Yes.
So why can't you say, I mean, I read your brief, you've got one paragraph devoted to 895.045, the other side is none. Why can't you just say that in the scheme of things, 8117 has been overrun in effect by a change in the liability situation and then a change in a 95045 as to liability among what reasons?
Because I don't think the enactment of the recent joint several law, all that did was change how you view the percentages. Okay. It didn't change the underlying basic assumption of contributory or comparative negligence. That goes back to Ainsworth versus Burr.
You would have thought they would have had a reference there that it doesn't apply to cities.
Well, but if you look at it that way, then you would write out 893.80 sub 3, which gives them immunity, because 895 doesn't say they still have immunity.
Well,
I mean,
you'd be that's rewriting a question of whether there's immunity or this is just a way of allocating liability is allocated by the jury, but a way of allocating who's going to pay contribution.
My point, though, Your Honor, would be that if he's saying when they redid 895.045 to change the way that comparative negligence is handled, and because that is silent, 8117 is no longer the law, why doesn't that apply to 893.80, which is the general immunity? That's not mentioned either.
One of the interesting things is I reread 895.045, and maybe I'm just not reading so well today, but I don't see any reference to joint liability or joint several liability. This talks about two people who are negligent, two entities who are negligent, when the jury is allocated a causal negligence between them. It doesn't talk about joint several liability.
My position would be that would support my argument, because of the Weiss decision and prior case law, which says it's not joint success.
That's right. So 895.045 seems to apply to success. That's my point. It doesn't talk about joint and several liability. It talks about where you have contributory negligence among two people and the jury is allocated. So it applies to success. On the face of it.
It would apply to joint and several, then, too.
Plus everything.
I mean, what? That's the analysis, guys.
You don't think it overrides 8117?
No, because then by implication, it's overriding every special rule, such as 8115, the 3-week rule. There has to be ice and snow on the ground for 3 weeks before the municipality is liable for not removing it. Does it overrule that rule because it doesn't mention 8115? When we did that statute, I mean, you're reversing and subsidential everything, basically, is what they're in their mouths. I guess for the court's consideration, I would ask you to look at a couple other cases that also deal with this. Counsel said there aren't really any cases on it, but there's a lot of cases on it. Justice Bradley referred to in case of 1890, I assume that's Raymond versus City of Sheboygan, where it said execution must be stayed against the city until an execution against the wrongdoer has been returned unsatisfied. That's straight out of the statute. The most recent case that I saw was the Dickens case from 1973, which says it creates a secondary liability in the city that applies when a tortfeasor other than the city contributes to the defrayment insufficiency. That's exactly what I'm saying. Rule 17 is covered. There are no cases which, as far as I can tell, I've looked at every single one that's cited in the applications. I don't think there are any cases that dispute them. Yes, but let me deal with the waiver issue for just a moment. Council, I think, was clearly aware that 8117 was there. First of all, it's in the pleadings. So, since you're no longer nervous pleading, we have that requirement. As I went back and I looked at a motion written to the plaintiff file, this is on the record 34, in which they specifically say that the city of Marinette contends it is Ken Keller's responsibility to backfill the trench pursuant to the contract. And they said nothing dispute exists as to whose responsibility it was to have the backfill pole. So they were aware of this. This is submitted prior to trial. They were aware of this as a potential issue. They didn't understand the significance of it, but it was there. It's in the pleadings. Anybody who goes to read that statute and even briefly looks at the annotations has got to see that, hey, this may dramatically affect our rights here.
Well, if I want a case for Fleming versus Thresherman's Mutual Insurance Company, familiar with that? I don't think it's cited.
It's more on insurance, as I recall.
Well, this was a case in which there was an intentional tortfeasor and then a negligent joint tortfeasor.
Yes.
And they entered into a release and settlement with the intentional tortfeasor. And the issue was then whether the negligent, the plaintiff could hold the negligent tortfeasor for any liability.
Yes.
And the court said that the negligent tortfeasor has a right to indemnity from an intentional joint tortfeasor. Apparent to release in that case operated to impute to the settling plaintiff, just like it does here, whatever liability and indemnity the settling defendant may have had to the non-settling defendants. That's what happened here. And to bar subsequent indemnity actions, the non-settling might assert against the settlement. And the court held that the Perringer release extended to the intentional tort cases, intentional misconduct, as well as its negligent misconduct. And so they said, well, because what you had was a circularity, because the plaintiff would be suing the plaintiff because of the
release.
Liable to the negligent one.
Yes. But that's different than the case
okay.
here.
What's the difference?
Because again, 8117 doesn't give the city a right against Keller, the contractor. It gives the city a right to require the plaintiff to take certain steps before it can collect from the city. Okay. It's not, in other words, it's not as though the contractor is indemnifying the city, which would be the analysis you're talking about, plus the intentional aspect thrown in there. It's just, I mean, what 8117 says is the plaintiff can't collect against us until they've got a judgment that's unsatisfied, and that can never happen here. I have nothing.
I sort of thought it helped you.
Well,
general concept that a plaintiff who enters into a peerage settlement with one party loses her claim against a second non-settling party.
And in that sense, I guess I understand, but there the question is really the cause of action goes away, and here it's not the cause of action, it's the collectability on the cause of action.
Okay.
And, frankly, that's a
risk. Tried.
That's a risk with a Perringer anytime. I mean, you're always having to evaluate, if I let this person out, are they going to end up being, you know, somehow primarily liable? And that's a gamble.
Could I ask one question?
Sure.
I don't quite understand the scope of 8117. Whenever damages happen to any person or property by reason of any defect in any highway or other public ground, that I think I understand, or from any other cause for which any town, city, village, or county would be liable. What does that mean?
What it was meant to mean originally, I don't know. It has been interpreted by this court in the past to be limited to highway defects. There's a case on point on that. I think that's the Webster versus Klugensmith, where there was a problem in a city street and a contractor was doing work and they put up one of those temporary sidewalk cover things because the sidewalk was closed and somebody walked through there and fell on that thing, and they said this applies to defects in the city or in the street, and the contractor didn't do anything to the street. All it did was put up a ceiling over it.
Is the only other tortfeasor, potential tortfeasor, a contractor?
Oh no. There are cases where they talk about somebody. I think there's a case where there was the county jail was alongside a city sidewalk, and there was a water valve for the sprinkler system for watering the lawn that caused the sidewalk to cave in, and somebody was injured there. And they said that was also the county was liable as the landowner for causing that to sink in. So it's not just a contractor, it's anyone who in some way contributes to the defect in the highway.
What I'm really getting at is, could the private tortfeasor be someone who didn't have a previous contractual relationship of some kind with the municipality?
That's my understanding, yes. I mean, in the county-city version, there was no contract particularly. The county had put in this valve as part of its land, which they're allowed to do, and then caused the sidewalk to cave in. There was no particularly contractual relationship there, as far as I'm aware.
But you don't have any private party that comes under 8117 in the case you just said.
Well, not in that one, but he was asking if there had to be a contract.
Okay, so just suppose somebody dumped an oil.
What I'm trying to get at is, here you have a pre-existing relationship between the contractor and the city. And they could have contracted for something, presumably. But I'm wondering if it's possible for simply a third party to suddenly enter the picture without ever any possibility of a contract.
Sure.
And be found liable and have to pick up the entire tab for what is primarily the municipality's negligence.
But, well, you're changing it at the very end there. I mean, if let's take an example. Let's say there's a building being constructed and the contractor, I mean, it's a private building, and the contractor drives a caterpillar down the middle of the street and chews it all up. I mean, they would be liable for the effects of that. If it lasts for 6 months, and so therefore you have arguably some notice to the city, that would be a joint liability. Perhaps there the jury would say that the city is more responsible because it let that condition sit for 6 months, but that would still trigger the statute.
I thought you said it's not joint liability.
I'm sorry?
I thought you said it wasn't joint liability.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not sure what I just said. It is, what the cases say is it's successive.
Successive. So, but under 8117, primary liability goes to that private contractor who dropped the load on the street.
Yes.
I think what you said, after 6 months and there's notice to the city or municipality, then there could be joint liability. Is that what you said?
Well, I guess I rephrase it. What it would do is it would bring in the possibility that the city could also be liable.
Okay.
It would still be successive liability.
Under 8117.
Yes.
What I guess I really don't understand is how you can argue beyond your basic position that this statute is not an anachronism. I mean, it would seem to me if you can have a private tortfeasor 1% responsible for an injury but held 100% responsible for the damages, I would think that tortfeasor has every incentive in the world to want to settle out for as little money as possible. And if you prevail, then it's all over.
That happens all the time. If you have a situation, for example, where there's a police chasing someone, and I've had cases like that, a police officer chases someone and somebody else happens to pull out in front of the person being chased and there's an accident. There could be 1% on the person who pulled out, and the jury could find 99% on the officer, but the officer's immune. So that 1%, under the old law at least, would still be responsible for all.
And that's not an anachronism?
That's the law.
But now auto accidents come under a different...
Sure.
A different provision in the statute.
They do. But I'm just giving an example of how there are cases all the time where there are special rules that apply to municipal defendants.
Let's take roadside vegetation, failure to cut.
Walker versus Bignell.
Pardon?
Walker versus Bignell.
Well, maybe something even more recently. But let's say there's, hypothetically, that the landowner doesn't cut the vegetation. But, of course, there's a responsibility for the municipality cut the vegetation. That's a claim under 8115. Law has indicated that insufficiency and want of repair can cover vegetation on the roadway. I mean, that would be an example where a private landowner may be liable, no prior contract, but certainly there's an 8115 claim against the municipality for the insufficiency and want of repair. You have those, I think, all the time. The time, but they're very common where you have some private entity, not just a contractor, someone who does some damage, leaves it there for a while, but the city also has a responsibility after the 3 weeks. Seems to me, maybe I'm wrong, that it's that common.
Well, I don't think the 3 weeks applies necessarily, because that's for ice and snow, but the basic concept.
Well, okay, ice and snow is another example, though, where you have, that's an 8115 claim, isn't it?
Yes.
Ice and snow,
yes.
With the 3 weeks requirement. But you can still have the store owner at Red Owl, who should have been putting some salt on that sidewalk, and you can bring a lawsuit against Red Owl Grocery Store for not doing that. But if it's been there for 3 weeks, can you still, in some instances, bring a lawsuit against the city?
If you're strictly talking the sidewalk and it's a public sidewalk, then I don't think the landowner would be responsible. But if he, for example, shovels his snow onto the public way and leaves it there, then that would create the situation you're talking about.
Are there any other successive liability statutes other than 8117?
Specifically in terms of municipalities, you mean? Or
anyone else. I just want to know. So I know that when we rule on the Perringer dealing with successive liability, I would like to know to what extent we're ruling on other matters. I don't know of any, but I
had not foreseen that question, frankly. I'm not sure in the tort scheme that there is outside of contractual allocations. It seems to me there's something in the Uniform Commercial Code that talks about sellers and buyers somewhere and about different routes for collectability, but I'm not sure that would really apply here. Off the top of my head, I don't know of any other.
So does this 8117 apply to stop signs?
Potentially could. I mean, if somebody with their own vehicle ran over a stop sign, knocked it down, and then fled the scene, I suppose in that sense it could. Now, again, then it gets into constructive knowledge because it would have to be down for enough time that the municipality would have to become aware of it. There are cases where it was knocked down an hour before another accident. They said that's not negligent on the city because they had no opportunity to do anything about it.
Suppose a municipality allowed a tree or something to obscure a stop sign. Could the municipality, but the stop sign was on private land.
I have to confess I'm not real positive. I remember the Walker versus Bignell case saying there was no liability for not trimming brush that prevented you from seeing the other intersecting road. The general rule is that if you put in a stop sign, you're obligated to maintain it, and that would include, I think, the trimming brushes to be able to see it.
Do you know the answer to my question to your opposing counsel earlier this afternoon about whether joint and several liability was the rule, or does this statute 8117 presuppose a regime of joint and several liability?
Yes, I think it did, although it was under the old, as I understand, it was under the old common law rule, which I think was if you have three defendants and they're all liable, they're each on for a third, and you know there wasn't a comparison per se. It was just however many are found liable, that's the ratio that you use.
Okay, so there was, at the time of the enactment of this statute, a common law rule of joint and several liability, different from what we have now, obviously, because it's been statutorily modified.
For tortfeasors, yes. That's my understanding.
So at the time the legislature was enacting this statute, it was doing so in an environment where joint and several liability existed. And we can assume that it had intended to supplant that with this concept of successive liability, primary and secondary.
Yes, and in addition, it was acting in the, that was well before the Holtz case in 62, which allowed claims generally. I mean, otherwise, the city would have been immune except for 8115, which said they're liable for highway defects.
Right, there was a statutory abrogation in the context of highway defects of common law substantive immunity for municipalities and municipal officers.
Yes.
And this went hand in hand with that, but my question went more to not whether this is an immunity statute, I don't think it is, but whether it is a statute that was intended to modify joint and several liability.
Yes, I think it, well, yes, in the sense that it's creating a successive liability. That's what the case
got rid of immunity.
I'm sorry?
Got rid of immunity. 8117 gets rid of immunity.
No, 8115 got rid of immunity. Okay. And 8117 tells you how you deal with it.
Right, so 8115 eliminates the immunity. 8117 says how you're going to collect.
Exactly.
So it imposes successive liability.
Exactly.
So do you agree or disagree with the Court of Appeals characterization of 8117 as a conditional immunity statute?
I can see why they would call it that, but I don't. I wouldn't call it that. I would call it a priority of collection statute, frankly. Time's up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Warr.
Chief Justice Abrahamson, very briefly, I think we've covered a lot of the issues. I don't view this as an immunity statute. I view it as a priority collection statute, as obviously co-counsel does as well. And we believe that under the specific terms of that statute, we can satisfy the conditions if it applies, and there are serious questions as to whether or not it even applies and whether the city waived its right to rely on that. Thank you.
Council, before you sit down, when I looked at the bench book that had a section on Perringer releases, one of the sections in the Perringer release is section C, and it says caution. And it sets out two examples where you got to be careful because, now I'm editorializing, that Perringer releases can be a trap for the unwary. For instance, caution. Number one, release of one defendant from liability for a defective product may release all whose liability is based on claim of strict liability in tort. Ooh, that could be kind of frightening if you have a...
I'm scared now, Your Honor, but...
Are you surprised?
I don't need that case to make me scared.
I know. But, I mean, that would cause me pause if I had a products case and I'm harangering out someone for a few thousand dollars and all of a sudden I realize, now, I note this is the bench book,
sure.
You know, and I'm not, and they use the term release of one defendant from liability for a defective product may release, so I think there must be fudging, and I didn't read the case that they're citing. I have it here, St. Clair Hospital, but I haven't finished reading it. The number two, another caution, Perringer release of intentional tortfeasor releases a negligent tortfeasor as well, since the negligent tortfeasor's right to recover from the intentional tortfeasor is based on indemnity, not contribution. That's the
right.
Case that the chief was citing, the Fleming versus Threshman's case. So in other words, if I were looking at this, I'd say, I don't know, these Perringers you got to be a little careful about. I also note, as your opposing counsel says, that he raised 8117 as an affirmative defense. So why, can you respond to the Court of Appeals, which essentially says you enter it at your own risk? What's your response to that kind of argument? There can be a trap for the unwary. It was raised as an affirmative defense. You knew of its existence, and yet you signed the Perringer release. How do you respond?
Well, Justice Bradley, I agree that they have the ramifications, but in this case, the ramifications are satisfied under 8117. As you will note, there wasn't 8117 noticed as a trap in the judicial bench book. From our perspective, granted, it was listed as an affirmative defense, but obviously the city of Marinette also knew about it then, and they had knowledge of what the Perringer would do, and from our perspective, they had a unique position to object to any type of Perringer relationship in this situation. They chose not to, for whatever reason. The plaintiffs chose to enter into a Perringer agreement with Keller, and the jury came back basically where the plaintiffs had settled with Keller, and it's our position that the rest of it remains unsatisfied in whole and in part, and the city's responsible for its 90%. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel, Mr. Ware and Mr. Farb, for their arguments with us this afternoon. Thank you for the MATC business law class for coming.